Eat your spinach and be strong like Popeye. There are more than a few reasons that that is not so. Today's show is about cooking spinach to get the most out of it. The Escoffier series continues with Chapter 13, Vegetables. Do you like cooked spinach? Probably most people make a face. It's probably not for everyone. It can be made much better than you've had it with a few additions. I used to love creamed spinach, and if it's done well, I still do. Let's take a seat at the table for some vegetable cookery ideas and tips. The Eating Liberty Podcast, episode 288, Food and Freedom, Once a Week for Life. Folks, Dan Reed here. Welcome back to the show. Over the years, as a cook and as a chef, I've cooked more than a few vegetables in more than a few different ways. I've turned vegetables into very pretty terrines for appetizer portions and was taught how to make an amazing vegetable tort. I should really go through that. Assembly aside, some basic cooking procedures always apply. Today we're going through Escoffier's Le Guide Culinaire, Chapter 13, still, Vegetables and Farinaceous Products, and, of course, the farinaceous products are at the end. So, as I mentioned, the Escoffier series continues today, and the first vegetable we're covering is spinach. Now, in French, spinach begins with an E, so we're moving along a bit more slowly than I had expected, but I think it's probably worth it. If you have memories of canned or frozen spinach, you are right to make a face. Fresh spinach used to be a bag of dirt with greenery attached. Now, that's a bit hyperbolic, but it's not far from the truth. They've improved production and packaging, so spinach today rarely needs a wash. Sometimes it needs... Sometimes it needed two washes to get all the sand and silt off. Spinach today mostly seems to be baby spinach, which is a much smaller leaf than the very large spinach that it used to be, and baby compared to how big spinach can get. When it gets really large, the stem is nearly inedible, and then it has to be removed. Baby spinach stems are fine to cook since they wilt right down to nothing, just like the leaves. Now, Escoffier boiled the fresh spinach and, in most cases, shocked it, squeezed out the excess water. There's a lot of water in spinach, you'd be surprised, even by sautéing it. And then he carried on with whatever the recipe was. When I was teaching culinary school, I learned the best way to cook spinach. Up until that time, it never occurred to me, and no one I knew, to do what I'm about to explain to you. Now, the setup for this is there is a cooking competition for professional chefs called the Bocuse d'Or. Bocuse after Paul Bocuse, and d'Or for French for gold, or the Golden Bocuse, named, of course, after Paul, which I just said. We showed one episode to our classical French cooking class to illustrate just how precise and elegant French food can be. After the competition was over, one judge, a chef, talking to the camera, offered a tidbit about cooking spinach, which, as a judge, was critical for a good score. So his answer to properly cooked spinach is to sauté it in whole butter, then add chopped garlic, grated fresh nutmeg at the end, a little bit of salt and pepper, and that's it. No boiling involved, no draining, no squeezing, none of that stuff. Now the garlic is added at the end, of course, so it doesn't burn, because the spinach is going to take a little while to cook. In this case, no color is desired on the garlic, even by me. The addition of those two simple flavorings, garlic and nutmeg, transforms the spinach into something far greater than just the ingredients used, and it really makes the spinach, it's just, it's one of those gestalt things where it's just so much bigger than the sum of its parts. It's hard to explain how incredible those two things enhance, bad English, the flavor of spinach. Making it up as I go. I recommend this procedure to anyone asks and sometimes to people who don't. The other way to make spinach is creamed. Now, of course, there are other ways, but the main ones are these two. Creamed spinach used to, and maybe still does, come in a can. It might even come in the freezer. I don't know. My parents used to buy it, and I liked it then. I moved on to homemade, and I like it better. If you check the interwebs for creamed spinach recipes, you'll find the first recipes use frozen spinach. That's fine. And some add creamed cheese or cream cheese to the sauce. That's cheesy spinach, not cream spinach. The Joy of Cooking cookbook offers a purist's recipe of only heavy cream. In all cases, the fresh spinach needs to be blanched and shocked and the water squeezed out. If you're using frozen, it needs to be thawed a day or two in the refrigerator or microwave on pulsing until it's no longer frozen and the ice crystals are gone. Squeeze the water out of that and, brother, you're going to get a lot of water. Be prepared, in either case, with fresh or frozen, to have far less spinach after squeezing than you expect. It's just, it has a way of disappearing. For 2 pounds of fresh, blanched, squeezed spinach, heat and reduce half a cup of heavy cream. Add the spinach to the cream and cook that until the cream reduces and coats the spinach. Now, it's possible, if the heat is too high, that the cream will get too thick too fast. So in that case, add a little bit of milk to bring it back. Finish with nutmeg and salt and pepper, and you're done. Some recipes will say chop the spinach after it's blanched, shocked, pressed. 6 for 1, 1/2 dozen the other. I don't do that just because it's one more step and one more thing to clean. And by the time the spinach is all blanched and shocked and squeezed, even the big leaves aren't that big to begin with, or to finish with. Now, one alternate method to make cream spinach is to start with a sauce bechamel, which is roux-thickened, milk-based sauce, and add that to the spinach and cook to the consistency you prefer, adjust the seasoning, and that's it. Now, to make the equivalent of half a cup of bechamel, it doesn't take more effort than it does to make 2 cups worth of bechamel, and the advantage is you have bechamel on hand. It is a good sauce to have on hand for almost instant cheese sauce for cauliflower or broccoli, or instant almost mac and cheese. It's a good soup base or for cream spinach. Now, Escoffier comes close to the sautéing procedure I mentioned with this recipe, Epinard's Mère Louisette. Now, I did mention that the French word for spinach begins with an E, and Epinard's, I'm sure I butchered that, is the word for that. So wash, dry, and chop the spinach, or use today's baby spinach. Sauté in whole butter until it's cooked and dry. Add a very small amount of diced ham, and so like 2 ounces for the 2 pounds of spinach, and croutons fried in clarified butter. Mix, season, and serve immediately. Obviously, the croutons will get soggy fairly quickly. Now, I sometimes render small diced bacon, leave all of the fat, and cook the spinach in that instead of the butter. Now, add the garlic and nutmeg, but I've never added the croutons, which sounds interesting. I like the idea of the crunch factor there. There are some recipes for stuffed spinach leaves that I'll not discuss. The task of unfurling a cooked, cooled spinach leaf, then stuffing it and folding it into a nice little package is more than a bit taxing. That we mostly don't have large spinach leaves now makes that just even more absurd. Swiss chard would work if you want to try the blanching, shocking, squeezing, unfurling, stuffing, rolling for some kind of a stuffed Swiss chard leaf. So recipe 4100, Subrique's Epinards is the recipe to follow for that, and kale or any of the various chards would work fine, although I don't know that, anyway, we already know how I feel about kale. One last recipe for spinach, which is easier, is to blanch and dry it, chop it roughly, then add an equal amount of Yorkshire pudding batter. Cook this as you would cook a crepe. Now, the idea is sound, and you can easily make a crepe batter. Add finely chopped spinach or spinach powder to the crepe batter to make green crepes. Now, that's really the main thing, is you're making a green crepe, but it's kind of fun, and if you're really feeling a little adventurous, make enough crepe batter to divide into thirds. One stays plain, one gets spinach, one gets tomato, and then when you're having a feast of Italy, you know, whatever, you get the idea. It's fun, but it's silly, but it's fun. Escoffier passes over fennel, which is too bad. As he says, quote, this vegetable is not much used very often, which is a pity, since it is of an excellent and delicate flavor, end quote. I agree. He does suggest cooking fennel in the same procedures as for celery or for cardoons. I'm going to give you one more, which he doesn't have. This was developed for a salmon dish at one of the restaurants I was working at. It can go with just about anything that is the same or milder than salmon. Now, I know that some of you are saying, well, salmon's a strong fish. Yeah, it is. It's kind of a strong fish, but it's not. It's a different strong than a grilled tomahawk chop. So it's a sliding scale. So this will be, I'm going to read this with some speed, but this is going to be on the show notes page where you can either copy paste or do whatever you want to have access to at least the text of the recipe. One large onion halved and sliced into quarter-inch half moons, two bulbs of fennel, stalks trimmed of the fronds, and the bulb and stalks diced into one-inch pieces, cut the core out, fronds saved for garnish, 8 ounces of diced tomatoes, you could use canned, 1 tablespoon of honey, 2 ounces of dry white wine, 2 ounces of water, 1 tablespoon of fennel seeds, salt and pepper, and extra virgin olive oil. So the process is pretty simple. In a heavy bottom saucepan, heat the oil, add the onions and the fennel seeds. Cooked to extract the aroma from the seeds and not really getting too much color on the onions. When the onions are wilted and the seeds are aromatic, add the diced fennel. Cook that until the edges of the fennel become translucent. Add the honey, wine, water, and tomatoes. Bring that to a simmer for 15 minutes or until the fennel is tender. And sometimes if the fennel is really big, it's going to take a little longer. Add the chopped fennel fronds at the end for garnish and serve. And when the restaurant, this was made ahead of time, the fronds were left out and added on pickup so that they stayed bright green and they offered that last little fennel fragrance. So the fennel fronds, like tarragon and basil and chives and all the other kinds of salad herbs, does have a flavor to it, but when it gets hot, that flavor is volatile. It goes away almost immediately. So trying to add that that greenery at the end as close to service as possible to get that complementary fennel flavor, but it's one other way. So you've got the fennel seeds toasted, then the fennel bulb in the stalks. And when you buy it in the store, it's generally going to have 3 to 4 or 5 inches of stalks on the bulb. Those, they can be a bit like celery. They're really hard to pull the fibers out of. If there's something, and they don't always exactly cook out. The stalks are not mandatory to go in here. They are excellent additions into stocks where they make their flavor contribution, then you strain them out. You can dice them smaller than 1 inch so that the pieces of strings, are smaller, so they're not quite as annoying to eat. So those three ways of the fennel. It's a nice little vegetable. It can even be a side vegetable all by itself. And that's one of those things that's better the next day. The last vegetable today is okra. Pickled okra is a popular use for okra, and maybe I've just not had a good version of it. I'm not a fan of pickled okra. It could be that the okra used in the pickling is too large, which means that it is way too tough. Fried okra is a bit addicting, especially if it's done fresh and eaten right away. And by a bit addicting, I'm being facetious. It's nearly impossible to stop eating. Breading okra is a messy but simple procedure. Now, we have adopted an Alton Brown procedure to suit our gluten-free needs, but the process is pretty much the same, and it's worth, for the visual part, going to watch somewhere on the interwebs. It might actually still be up, his okra episode from Good Eats. What we do is combine equal parts of cornmeal, coarse grind, and gluten-free flour, all-purpose flour, salt and pepper. Mix that thoroughly into a 1 gallon zip-top bag. So probably two cups of cornmeal, 2 cups of the gluten-free flour, salt and pepper. A little heavy on the salt because okra can take it, and it's going to taste unseasoned if it's not enough. And then all that stuff in the zip-top bag. Now, one of my big pet peeves is frozen okra. Cut frozen okra seems always to include more than a few pieces of the stem end. I don't want to eat the stem end. I'm pretty sure nobody wants to eat the stem end. It's this little stump. It's like a little okra thumb. It's useless. I'm paying for trash. So, to start, I trim all of the stem ends off and put them in the compost bin. Cut each okra piece into about half-inch piece. Now there's a fine line where okra gets a little bit too big, and when you cut into it, small okra up to 3 inches or so, it's really nice and tender. The knife goes right through it with no problems. When the okra gets a little bit bigger, you can start to really see some of the fibers even on the outside. And as you cut through that, you can sort of hear and feel this takes more knife effort. If the okra is feeling tough because it's extra big, then I cut the pieces a little bit thinner so that that cooked piece isn't like chewing on a stick. Now, I'm maybe I'm just delicate. I don't know. So, all the okra is cut, soak it in water for about 15 minutes. To bread the okra pieces, lift them out of the water with a perforated spoon. Perforated means it's got holes in it. That's a kitchen term, maybe. Maybe you know what that is. Let the water drip as much as is possible, and quite honestly, it's just going to look like okra snot hanging on the spoon. And you can try and rub the spoon on the edge of the bowl to encourage more of that water, the mucilage, to come off. Then add that spoon of somewhat drained okra pieces to the bag of flour. Now, one tip is to fold the top of the Ziploc bag down about halfway. So when you're spilling stuff, you are going to be spilling stuff. It's not going on the top part, the seal of the bag. It's all going to kind of end up making a big mess anyway, but it seems to delay some part of the mess. Fold the bag up, seal it, or fold it over a couple times. Give it a really good shake to make sure that all of the okra pieces separate and get coated in the cornmeal, flour, salt, pepper mixture. Then let them sit 30 seconds. So what we want to make sure happens is that the wet okra is adhering to, is grabbing onto the flour bits, and that the flour bits are starting to hydrate a little bit and stick to those okra pieces. That's really going to be a critical point to our fried okra, so that all of those things stay together. And we don't want the breading coming off in the fryer because it's not breaded okra anymore. When that's done, I use my hands to carefully lift them out, shake them to get the excess cornmeal off, and then lay them in a single layer on a rack on a sheet pan so that the air goes all around them. And the main thing is, if you put the breaded okra on a sheet pan where the air does not get to get to it, then the part of the okra in contact with the pan won't ever get a chance to dry out a little bit. The moisture will continue to sog out the flour, and it won't fry nice in the fryer. And that may be a place where it's going to come off. That same idea, putting your breaded thing on a rack, on a single layer. So if you put okra too high together, the same problem is going to happen. It may actually start to stick together, and it won't. Then it should be this big glump in the fryer, which may not cook all the way in the middle. And then we have this breading problem and the frying problem. So one layer on a rack for, you know, fish fingers, chicken fingers. Fish don't have fingers. Fish fingers, chicken fingers, beef fingers, whatever you're using, anything that's breaded, lay it out on a rack on a sheet pan. The sheet pan's there to catch whatever falls. And then you're going to have a much better fried finished product. Now, you usually I sort of eyeball this, but make enough to do 2 quarter sheet pans worth. And sometimes I can put some part of that pan in the freezer and then freeze them while they're breaded, put them in a Ziploc bag, and then I have some breaded okra at the ready for whenever we want to have it, which is a nice convenience to have. Now, Escoffier didn't include fried okra in his book. One procedure that sounds interesting and is simple is to trim them. He would cut the little point end off as well as the stem end. I'm more ambivalent about the point end. I don't include it in the fried okra simply because it doesn't have mucilage to hold the breading. So trim the ends, blanch them well. I don't know precisely what that means. Remove them from the water, let them drain a moment, then finish cooking them in butter. Add a little cream sauce at the end and serve. So this would be a place where bechamel would come in handy. You could cook them in butter, and before they are completely browned and done, add some whole cream, whole heavy cream, same thing, I guess, to the pan, sort of like the joy of cooking discussed for cream spinach. But I've never had creamed okra, and it sounds kind of interesting, and we like okra more than just fried, although pretty stinking good. At the Governor's Club, okra was sautéed, cut into about the same half-inch or so piece, with peeled, diced tomatoes as a vegetable with a grouper dish. Now, I'm pretty sure we added at least garlic to that, probably a little bit of butter, definitely extra virgin olive oil, salt and pepper, and probably that was it, because it was really the focus on the okra and on the tomatoes. It is a great combination. It can be done pretty quickly without too much prep, and there's no soaking of the okra. Now, okra is probably most famous for the mucilage, which I've mentioned, which is the mucousy slime stuff that comes out of it. The best way to avoid exposing the mucilage is to cook small okras whole, like in a cream sauce or sauteed with tomatoes. Now, we did cut the okra for that particular dish, and it didn't really ever get too slimy in the container in the refrigerator. It's when they come into contact with water that the mucilage really shows up. The best size of okra is about the size of your finger. Now, that brings into question, how big is your finger? If your finger is close to the size of mine and you can't see it, then you're in good shape. If your finger is about the size of Shaq's finger or Jordan's finger, then probably those are too big. When okra gets too big, it does get woody, as I've mentioned, and there's no fixing that. And you can pickle all you want to, and you're not going to stop that. So thin slices and fried is maybe the best use for it, or you can use it for gumbo. Now, we did an episode about okra a while back, episode 156, and on that show notes page, I included a gumbo recipe. I'll add a link to that show on the show notes page. Too many words. On this show notes page, good grief, culinarylibertarian.com/288. Now, the recipe there is for seafood gumbo, but it's easy enough to change it to any other kind of gumbo, change the ingredients, and change the stock. And pretty much there you go. Fried okra may be a southern thing. I've never seen it served with a sauce. It is a bit like popcorn in that no matter how much you make, it's never really enough. Well-seasoned is best. And I don't think it needs a sauce. I don't even know how you'd eat it with the sauce. Maybe, maybe kind of like smothered. Maybe make a good barbecue sauce and squirt that over the top. That's actually a fun idea. I don't know why I didn't think of that. All right, well, now we have a new thing to try. All right, folks, that's going to do it. I'm happy for now to report that I've got about 10 okra plants that appear to be doing quite well as seedlings. There is some kind of okra virus that little seedlings succumb to, which makes them die as they are starting. Now, I sort of figured that I've seen this happen, and I didn't know what it was, and I went hunting last year because of the 10 plants I bought, 2 survived, and the other one just withered away, kind of like the souls in The Little Mermaid at the bottom of the sea. I'm hoping I'm going to miss that this year, and it's starting to look that way, but I'm not tempting anything. From what I read, it seems to be in soil, and that's a real drag because there's no way to know if it's there, but it looks like things are looking up this year. The blackberry bush is incredible. It's, oh my gosh, it's going to be a monster. I added a new raspberry plant to the raspberry patch. Now, I don't know if that's going to bear this year, but the rest of the canes are looking great, and so there's reason to be hopeful for this summer. And I just got back from a jaunt in the woods looking for morels and did okay. Now, there's a few things I learned today about morels. One of them is that they don't all come up at once. The mycelium. Now, the other thing I haven't figured out is of the hundreds of miles maybe of morel mycelium or any other mushroom mycelium in the ground, why in any particular spot did that mycelium make a mushroom and not an inch away? Now, if you're a morel hunter, you know that sometimes, today was one of those days, that you find a bunch of 2 or 3. Then you look around, and 5 feet away, there's another one, and then there's just you're almost in this little miniature, Oh, what the heck is that stupid book? Anyway, you're this giant in this field of morels, and that happened, and that was a lot of fun. So, they don't all have the same habitat. Michigan is hardwoods, Oregon is pine. And the higher you get, we were at nearly 6,000 feet today, and we might have been early, which is a crazy thing to think, but it's all very exciting. It's a lot of fun looking for them. As I said, the text for this show will be on the show notes page, culinarylibertarian.com/288. And if you grow fennel, then this is going to recipe that's going to wait until, say, August, but it is a great, it's light, it's fresh, it's airy, good summertime veg. Never had a cold, so I don't necessarily know how that would go. It would taste less amazing because cold deadens the sense of taste, but it really is fantastic when it's hot. So, and it could even be turned into a pasta sauce for something. So, all right. Have a good week, and I'll see you soon.
Music for the Culinary Libertarian podcast is provided by Matthew Bankert at mattbankert.com.